I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri has a new voter ID law, and it's raising concerns with voter rights advocates. In June, two groups joined forces and sued the Show Me State in an attempt to stop enforcement of what they see as unnecessary requirements designed to make it harder for people to vote. Today, we'll speak with the leader of one of the plaintiffs, the League of Women Voters of Missouri, and Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft about what this means for voters at the polls next week. But first, inspiration for a late summer road trip. We'll take you on a bucket list journey of 100 things to do in America before you die, with stops in Kansas and Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If you like lists as I do, then here's a good one for you. Name the 100 things you should do in America before you die. Bill Clevelin did it for his new book by that name, and he came up with a list that's full of ideas, and some of which you might have guessed and others that I guarantee that you have not. And he includes some spots from our neck of the woods as well. Bill Clevelin is a broadcaster and national travel writer based in St. Louis. He hosts a weekly radio show and podcast called Bill on the Road that features road trip ideas and uplifting American stories. Bill Clevelin, welcome.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for taking some time. And our listeners need to weigh in here because I know they'll have lots of ideas too. What's on your list of things to do in America before you die? 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Well, Bill, why a list of 100 things to do in America before you die?
Well, first, I have to tell you, I was going to buy a T-shirt when I came to Kansas City, but now I'm thinking about buying one of those gold-plated sneeze guards. Nice little souvenir for my ride
that
home.
That caught your attention, eh? Yeah.
Kansas City's fantastic. I've been coming there since I was a kid. My dad brought me there in the, I guess, mid-'80s to see George Brett play for the Royals. And so the experience in Kansas City, in this whole book, is nothing but experiences, which is a little bit different from a lot of travel books. You know, a lot of times it's just destination. So I really wanted to do a book where everything is an experience. So instead of just going someplace, you're going to be doing something at these places. And one of the chapters in the book I call photo ops, because I refuse to use the word selfie, even mm-hmm. though it's part of the culture now. And I love the fountains in Kansas City. Yeah. And I just think it's uniquely American. It's one of those just really cool experiences. And so the experience in Kansas City, because I've loved doing it, is taking pictures with those great fountains. And obviously, have to spend quite a few days to do all of the fountains, but that's what's in the book for Kansas City.
More fountains here than like in any other major American city, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Second only to Rome in the world. So you've got that going for you.
How tough was it, Bill, boiling this list down to just 100? Because some people might say there's at least 1,000 or maybe 5,000.
Yeah, so here's how I did it. This will sound funny, but I always tell audiences this. I sort of wondered what would happen if an alien came down from outer space and had no concept of what America was, right? So you go, you can't explain, how would you explain it to someone that's never heard of it or doesn't know any of the history? So that's what I try to do. I try to tell the American story through travel. So all 100 of these things tells a little slice of the American story. So you've got culture, you've got food, you've got sports. You've got quirky little things like, you know, the American Vacuum Museum.
I saw that.
You know, these, yeah.
That's
these
in Missouri, isn't it?
It is. It's in St. James, Missouri. And it's actually really cool. It was one of those kind of off the beaten path stops. And I'm so glad that I went in. But it was difficult. A lot of index cards on the floor. And I finally narrowed it down.
Well, I think all the vacuum cleaners there are still operating too, aren't they?
They really are, which is really neat. The guy got his collection from Stan Kahn. You may remember he was on the Tonight Show quite a bit with Johnny Carson. He'd come out with his vacuum cleaner collection. He played organ at the Fox Theater here in St. Louis for many years. And anyway, this guy collected his collection along with his own And it's really neat. Yeah, they all still work and kind of tell this interesting story when the vacuum cleaners were gigantic, and then you walk through the different decades to, you know, what we have today. It's pretty neat.
Well, where did the ideas for things to do come from, Bill? I mean, or did you come up with all of these on your own?
Yeah, so as a travel writer, travel journalist, obviously I crisscross the country, and I'm very fortunate to get to do a lot of interesting things. And when you go to different cities, people always have their little, you know, hidden gems or their little things that, they like to tell visitors to do. And so, you know, I've been a broadcaster most of my life. I started Bill on the Road a little over four years ago. And so it's been an amazing experience and getting to do so many of these really cool and sometimes even quirky things. And so, yeah, most of them I will give my ex-girlfriend actually does get credit for one. She gets credit for one. And it's really a good one. It's trying Thomas Jefferson ice cream at Mount Rushmore. Did you know you could get ice cream at Mount Rushmore?
I did not.
Yeah, Mount Rushmore obviously is on almost anyone's travel bucket list, but instead of just going to Mount Rushmore, you go and you try Thomas Jefferson's recipe for ice cream. He was supposedly the very first person in the United States to record a recipe for ice cream, and they serve it at Mount Rushmore. So that's the experience there.
As opposed to Monticello, right?
Right. No, I don't know if they serve it there, but certainly at Mount Rushmore.
Well, do you have a top three? If I just asked you to say, what are your top three experiences, what would you tell me?
I don't know that I have three in particular that are my favorite. There are some that I always really do try to suggest to people. One, I say go to Sun Studio in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes,
That's one anyone can. Have you been?
Yes, I have.
What an incredible experience!
Yes,
you stand there for folks who don't know. You walk into this place and you'll know. You walk in and it's not been updated. It's not been. You look up in the ceiling tile. It's like it's going to fall on your head.
Yeah.
And it is where Elvis Presley recorded his first song. His first, I guess. When he was first discovered, and they will play for you that very first recording. And you talk about goosebumps. It's unbelievable. But not just so much for Elvis, but to think about the domino effect in our culture that happened because of that moment. Think of all the things that happened throughout American history, specifically in culture, because of Elvis and because of how he was discovered. And when you start to think about those things while you're standing there, it's really kind of an overwhelming moment.
Mm-hmm.
Sun Studio is one. Since I'm from St. Louis, I always tell people, and it's certainly in the book, is you have to go to the top of the Gateway Arch.
Yeah, sure.
It's something we do here as a kid. You go as a, you know, on a field trip, and then you don't do it again for 40 years. But it's a really neat experience. That's one that I like to throw in there. And another one, and this will apply to folks in Kansas City, I say visit a presidential library. A lot of folks don't know about them. You talk about the greatest history lesson that you can have going to these different presidential libraries, regardless of your politics. It doesn't even matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go to a place like, you know, you go to the, I don't know, the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library down in Atlanta, and you walk in and they actually have the sweater that he was wearing when he gave his famous energy speech in the 70s.
Yes.
You know, I mean, just these things that you can't find in a history book. It's amazing. So, yeah, those would be my three. And I only mentioned Kansas City because you guys have obviously the
Truman Library.
The Truman Library, which is great there in Independence. Yeah.
We're talking about 100 Things You Should Do in America Before You Die, a new book out by Bill Cleveland by that name. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jeff from Quality Hill. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to highly recommend a train trip from Kansas City to the Grand Junction. You get on Amtrak at night in right downtown at Union Station.
Right.
And then you go to a place called Williams Junction. You would detrain there and then overnight at Williams. And then the next morning there's a tourist train that takes you right to the South Rim. And words like spectacular and overwhelming wouldn't be strong enough to mention what the Grand Canyon is actually like when you're there. So do you have that in your book, The Grand Canyon?
So the Grand Canyon is mentioned. So the specific experience at the Grand Canyon is to ride a mule either down to the bottom
right.
or around the rim of the Grand Canyon, which I have done. And it's an incredible experience, as you mentioned. The last time I went was in early March of last year, and it was covered in snow and ice. And that's awesome because there are very few tourists there. And to see it covered in snow is also an amazing, amazing experience. So, yeah, absolutely the Grand Canyon's in there.
That mule ride can be kind of harrowing, can it?
You know, they call him a sure-footed mule. I mean, that's what they say. And they,
it better
know, the first
be.
Question, yeah, the first question was, well, my God, has anybody fallen off of one of these things? And they're like, no, we've been doing this over 100 years. Nobody's ever died. So they say, I don't know. Yeah. But I did it, and you're right. It's really amazing. It's a one-of-a-kind experience.
Jeff. Well, I hope that people will consider doing this because it's really easy to get there from Kansas City taking the train.
Right.
And so I think that people should strongly consider that. I think it's something everybody should see.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the good call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Joe from Lenexa. Joe, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, how many of the 100 things to do before you die are seeing nature, like the Grand Canyon or the Redwood Forest, and how many of them are man-made events?
That's a really great question. You know, when I first started coming up with the list, so many of them ended up being national parks that I had to go back and go, well, this is going to end up being the national park book, because we are so fortunate in this country to have so many opportunities to see great things, like you mentioned, the forests or the Grand Canyon or whatever. I would say I don't know the exact number off the top of my head without really diving into it, but I would say that probably there are 10 or 12 experiences where you're in the outdoors and you're doing hiking or you're kayaking or things like that. And these had to be specific to the United States. So like I said, everything that's in this book, I wanted to tell the American story. So some things that we can do in this country, you can certainly do in other parts of the world. So I really tried to focus on things that you can only do here in the United
States. All right. Hope that helps, Joe. Let's go to Ellen here. Ellen from the Northland. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I would like to suggest that a visitor would go to a powwow and dance the round dance, which is always open to everyone.
Dance the round dance. Easy. Yeah. Where can you do that, Ellen?
Well, you can do that at many, many powwows. There's a wonderful one in May every year at Haskell in Lawrence, Kansas. There's always.
What about tonight?
Tonight. I'm sure there's a powwow tonight somewhere in the country. They're online calendars. They're easy to find.
Yeah.
Almost every reservation has one.
That's a good one, Ellen. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. You know, there were a bunch of items that caught my eye here, Bill, and one was ride the Comet bobsled at Utah Olympic Park. I didn't even know about this. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So as you know, that's where the Olympics were held in, was it 2004? I have my all my days off here.
Right.
So they had the Winter Olympics were hosted there recently. And so what's first of all, what's really cool is that we sort of, I guess you would say, recycle or reuse these Olympic events, whereas a lot of places around the world don't. You know, they just let them go to pot, and it's really sad. And so they've done an amazing job at the Utah park, and they've let people now year round. So if you go there during the winter, obviously you can do the bobsled with an Olympian, with you know, somebody that's a professional, and you get in the thing and you go, and it is unbelievable. But in the summertime, they basically put wheels on the thing, so because there's no ice.
Yeah,
so
right.
You can ride it at any time of the year. But again, that's one of those just unbelievable experiences where, yeah, you can go and you can go to, you know, go to the area and see the beauty of the area. But that's one specific thing that you can do that you're probably not going to do anywhere else.
And you're talking 60 miles an hour, right?
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I'm a pretty adventurous guy. I rarely turn anything down, any experience. But yeah, you have to be brave. You have to be brave, but it's worth it. It's really cool.
You know, another one was go kayaking in the Everglades, and I've been on a fan boat down there, and there were so many alligators. I can't imagine getting down that close to the water in a kayak, but you did it.
Yeah, and so the interesting thing there, I'll be honest with you, Steve. So I actually, when I was in, went to Naples, Florida last year, 2 years ago now, and I actually had heat exhaustion while I was there, it wasn't actually a pleasant experience for me. I need to go back and actually do it again because I didn't really enjoy it as much as I should have. But it's Naples, Florida, and getting down into the Everglades. just an amazing part of the country, and getting to experience that with, like you said, I'm a little, they kind of freak me out, the crocodiles and the alligators.
Oh, yeah.
a little bit, but still, you know, the guides, they know what they're doing, you know, you're going to be safe. And, yeah, nobody was thrown overboard. So yeah, no, a very cool experience.
One more that I liked a lot, and I wondered if I would ever get there in my life, was go fishing on the Kenai River in Alaska. Sounds wonderful.
It does sound wonderful, and I'm going to be quite honest with you. That is one that I haven't done. So there's about 10 experiences in the book that I still haven't even checked off my bucket list because I needed to include them. You know, I thought about, you know, saying, well, I did all these things all across America, and so I want you to do them too. But there were some things that I thought, boy, I would really like to do this. So I decided to include. There's about 10 that I still haven't accomplished, and that is one that I want to do also. So a couple of friends of mine are from Alaska, and that was what I did. I said, what is the one thing in the entire state of Alaska that you would suggest doing? And I could put in this book. And without hesitation, that was the experience they said to have. So maybe you and I can go on a trip to Alaska and crank that out.
We're talking about 100 things to do in America before you die. Let's go to Sandy from Miriam. Sandy, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Steamboat Arabia Museum. Oh, my goodness. And talk about the history of America. 1856. Oh my gosh! And if he's here in town, he should definitely do that today.
It's a good one, Sandy.
So I've done that. It is an amazing museum. In the book, there are also what I call in the neighborhood section. So because I couldn't include everything, there are a lot of cities or a lot of destinations where I will go, you know what, there's probably four or five other things I'd really like to suggest to people. And in the Kansas City section where I mentioned the fountains or the one experience, there are four or five other things that I always suggest. And in the book, I suggest that people do as well. So the Arabia Museum is absolutely in the book for folks to know about.
There could be 100 things to do in America before you die, book two coming up, Bill.
No, I'm not doing another one.
One's enough.
That was fun.
Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Great. I was going to suggest also a drive up the Hudson River Valley through the Catskill Mountains, a magical part of the country, one of the most beautiful parts of the country, and a, you know, top secret. Nobody realizes that. And maybe drive on up into the Adirondacks as well, which is the largest wilderness in North America. And as a quick add-on, I would say, which I just thought of, Christmas Eve in Santa Fe, one of the most magical Christmases you will ever experience. But
interesting.
It's really unlike anything anywhere else. But the drive up the Hudson River Valley.
That's a great one. Danny Alexander, our producer, is nodding her head vigorously here, saying you're absolutely right. I appreciate that. Well, Bill Clevin, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for taking some time with us. Bill's new book, 100 Things You Should Do in America Before You Die. And what a great set of lists, Bill. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll be at the Kansas City Public Library
6:30 Wednesday evening.
6:30.
Yeah, more information where you can see and hear Bill, just go to kclibrary.org, 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza. All right. Bill, thanks again.
My pleasure. Take care.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Missouri voters about some tips with this new voter ID law that's now in effect. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we listened to the Kansas City, Kansas mayoral debate held at Donnelly College. The election takes place today. And if you want to learn more about the candidates, head on over to kcur.org/uptodate or find a conversation on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, how starting a business is helping veterans reconnect with civilian life. Also, we discuss what's delaying bike lanes here in Kansas City. Well, Missouri is doing something for the first time at its elections next Tuesday, and that is insisting that voters show a photo ID before casting a ballot. The law remains intensely controversial. Lawsuits have been filed to halt its implementation, but the law is the law, and it's probably a good idea to have some idea of what you need to have in your possession next week when you show show up at the polls. We have some terrific experts here to offer us a guide of the law's requirements. We hope to have Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft with us in just a couple of moments. Here in the studio with me is Evelyn Maddox. She is co-president of the League of Women Voters for Kansas City and Jackson, Clay, and Platte counties. The League is one of several groups that has gone to court to halt implementation of this law. Evelyn, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Erica Hunzinger is the Politics, Education, and Criminal Justice Editor for KWMU over in St. Louis. And Erica, nice to have you. We should have Erica here with us in just a couple of minutes. Secretary Ashcroft, are you here? Secretary, are you here? Okay, Jay Ashcroft will be with us in just a minute as well. Well, Evelyn Maddox with the League, what's your take on this new law? How prepared do you think Missourians are to comply with it?
Our work in the League of Women Voters in our area, which does include four election boards, has shown us that few voters are prepared for the experience that they are going to have at the polls when they go to vote on August 8th.
And your concern is what? Why are they so ill-prepared?
Well, we believe they are ill-prepared because they either have not seen any publicity that the law does require this photo ID, or they didn't integrate it, you know, and just they might have heard photo ID and thought, I have a driver's license, or I have something, or I've always voted, so it'll be okay for me. And then they don't know the details of the law.
Let me see if I have Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft with us now. Mr. Secretary, are you here?
Good morning, I am. Thanks.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking some time, Mr. Secretary. I appreciate it. You just heard Evelyn Maddox describe her concerns, people not prepared to understand fully what this new law is all about. What's your take on this?
Well, I think she kind of misunderstands the law right there. Anybody that's voted before, that's walked into a polling place and turned over that piece of identification, they can still go to the polling place on election day and turn over that same piece of identification. They'll be allowed to vote. I think it's unfortunate that we have people that are fear-mongering about this issue when the very crux of this new law is that if you're a registered voter, you can vote.
Evelyn?
Well, what Secretary Ashcroft has not mentioned here is that for some voters, they will be required to sign in a statement which does ask them, do they possess an ID? And they must swear under penalty of perjury that they do not possess an ID. And for some people, that will be confusing. They might have one at home. They didn't bring it. They don't yet fully understand what the photo ID is. And mainly, the average reader who reads this statement doesn't understand what it really means. And for those voters, they might say, I won't sign anything I don't understand.
Mr. Secretary?
The statement actually is very simple. What's going to happen when you go in to vote is you're going to be asked to show your government-issued photo ID. If you don't have it, then either you can show one of the other forms of identification you've used before, or the poll worker will explain to you the other forms of identification you can use. And in fact, if you don't have any ID at all, you're allowed to use a provisional ballot. But the statement that you would sign if you don't have a photo ID has three simple readings of the Missouri law on it. One, it says that under Missouri law, you're asked to show a government-issued photo ID to vote. Two, you don't have one. That's why when they asked you for a photo ID, you didn't present one. And three, that the state of Missouri will happily provide you a free photo ID if you'd like for the purposes of voting. You'll sign that, and you'll go ahead and vote. And most people won't even know the difference because that's how we've made this law. It's easy and make sure that every eligible voter can vote.
Evelyn, the secretary says it's easy.
We have found it is not easy in the sense that voters who are not prepared for their experience at the polls of being told, yes, I understand you've always voted with your utility bill, but now we do require you to sign this statement. That's going to be a surprise for most voters because there has not been an intensive effort to educate voters. We at the League are doing our best to educate voters, but that surprise alone will dampen their willingness to sign the statement.
Let me get our listeners to chime in here. If they have questions, we have two great experts here who can help you navigate this new law. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's get down into the weeds here just a little bit. What about this question, Mr. Secretary? What types of IDs will be accepted at my polling place?
You can use any of the forms of ID you've been allowed to use previously. If you use that government-issued photo ID, that Missouri, the current Missouri driver's license, Missouri non-driver's license, that passport or military ID, you'll just sign the register and go ahead and vote. If you use any of the other forms of identification that we've allowed people to hand over, such as their voter registration card, their ID card from a university, college, vocational school, or technical school located in Missouri, utility bill, bank statement, government check, paycheck, or other government document showing your name and address, you'll sign that statement informing you that under the Missouri law, they request a photo ID, you don't possess one, and that we will provide you one for free if you'd like one, and you'll go ahead and vote.
If you go ahead and vote, Mr. Secretary, will your vote be counted as anyone else's vote would be counted who is a fully registered voter and has a photo ID, or will it be a provisional vote?
If you use any of those forms of identification, your vote will just be counted in the normal course of action as everyone else's is. The only time you use a provisional ballot, I'm glad you brought this up. Because when people talk about whether or not registered voters will be able to vote, we've actually had registered voters that have shown up before and haven't been able to identify themselves, and they've been turned away. Under this new law, even if you show up in a pair of swimsuits and your swimsuit and flip-flops, you can vote a provisional ballot, and your signature on your voter registration can be used to verify your signature on your ballot, and you'll get to vote. This law actually increases ballot access to make sure that truly every registered voter has access to that ballot and their vote will count.
Mr. Secretary, what is a provisional vote? What is that?
A provisional ballot was designed because elections are timely. If you come in to vote and we say, gee, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to let you vote, and we don't let you vote until Wednesday, it's too late. If we say, oh, yeah, you should have been able to vote. But the whole idea of a provisional ballot is to say, we're going to go ahead and let you cast a ballot. We'll put it in this sealed envelope. We'll put it in this sealed container. And then we will verify your eligibility to cast that ballot. We don't know how you voted because it's inside a sealed envelope. Once the election is over at 7 o'clock that night. So that way, if we say, yep, you should have been able to vote, we go ahead and we count that ballot. We want to make sure that every registered voter gets to vote. And that's how you make sure that happens.
Evelyn Maddox with the League, weigh in here if you would.
Yeah, Steve, one reason there's so much confusion about this issue and one reason it's controversial is that the law was not well written, House Bill 1631.
Mm-hmm.
And it essentially doesn't take into account that it's the election board in each of our Missouri counties who carries out the training for poll workers. So a voter's experience at the poll will depend upon how well that election board trained its workers there.
And that's one of your concerns, if I understand right, Evelyn, is that the training for these workers all across the state of Missouri hasn't been done as well as you think it should have been done.
That is true, because we have already experienced reports from the election in St. Louis that there was a variance in the voters' experiences when they approached the poll worker to vote. Their experience varied depending upon the knowledge of that poll worker. And that's what will happen here, I'm quite sure, in our local election boards.
Mr. Secretary Jay Ashcroft, how well trained are the poll workers across the state as far as you're concerned?
They've done a great job with that. One of the things that we've also done is our co-directors of elections have visited every one of the local election authorities before they have an election under this law to make sure that they understand the rules, that they make sure what their poll workers need to know, and that they're helpful with the poll worker training. I'd like to respond just for a minute to something that was said earlier about the St. Louis election. We've actually released the data on every registered voter that went into a polling place to vote, not their specific individual data, but everyone that went to vote was able to vote. And we've released the data on how many people used driver's licenses, how many people used voter registration cards, the three people that used the provisional ballots. And every registered voter that went to vote on that day was allowed to vote.
Okay.
We didn't give out any private information in that. It's all aggregate and explains that you can vote the way that the law is, that the poll workers understood the law. In fact, I was walking into one of the polling locations and a lady was walking out mentioning that she didn't have her photo ID with her. And I stopped her and politely said, ma'am, you can still go ahead and vote. And she said, I know, the poll workers told me there was another way I could vote, but I just wanted to go back to get my driver's license. The poll workers are trained. They're working hard. If you're a registered voter, go to your polling place. Ignore what people are telling you about you won't be able to vote. You will.
Okay. Evelyn?
Steve, what he said might be true. I have no basis to dispute it, but what I do have in my hand is a card from my own election board. And on this, this is the card that tells me where to go to vote. And this is my regular card I receive every time there's an election.
Mm-hmm.
On it is simply a stamped message. Photo ID is now required in Missouri. This is not a valid form of ID. This is not a valid form of ID. I have been told by a different election board official.
Meaning that the card you received in the mail is not a valid form of ID.
That's
what
right.
your point is here.
But I've been told by another election board that they would regard this postcard, which gives me where I go to vote, as a valid form of ID with the statement that I were would be required to sign if I signed it.
Mr. Secretary, we're talking about these postcards that voters typically receive
right.
shortly before an election that tells them, hey, an election's coming up and here's where you go and vote. Respond to Evelyn if you would.
If you what you received is your voter registration card, then that will be allowed to be used, and what your local election authority has told you about being able to use that is true.
But she's talking about the regular notification. Yeah.
If it's just like they use for canvassing, if it's not the voter registration card, that wouldn't work. But realize that let's say you walk into the polling place and all you have is that card, you can still vote because we have an option three for people that have no identification with them. You know, we need people getting out there and making sure that people of this state know that if they're registered, they can vote. We
okay.
shouldn't be telling them they won't be able to.
This may not come as a surprise to anybody here, given the tenor of our conversation, but we have a full board of calls here with people with questions
right.
about this new law. Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Kevin, you're on Up to Date.
Good morning. Thanks for this. This is an important show to have.
Thanks, Kevin.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. The Attorney General said full-throated, frankly, that this was fear-mongering, when, in fact, we need to come back and point this out for exactly what it is. And this is more Republican Party and spearheaded by the right wing specifically, efforts to disenfranchise more and more Americans, more blacks, more minorities, more Hispanics, more elderly, more physically challenged, anybody and everybody who frankly will possibly vote Democratic. And it's, of course, how they got George W. Bush in the presidency.
Well, Kevin, let me hold
and
on.
It is in fact how they got the current president in the White House.
Mr. Secretary, respond to that complaint from Kevin, because this is something I'm sure you've heard before.
You know, I have, and it's unfortunate that people continue to peddle that. I've spent 2 years going around the state challenging anyone to point to a single individual that would not be able to vote under this law, and no one's been able to take the challenge and point to a single individual. This law actually increases ballot access. More people are able to vote under this law, as long as they're registered voters, than were under the prior law. If you are a registered voter, there is no reason in this law for you not to go to your polling place and participate.
Evelyn, this notion that this is a Republican effort to quash the vote, respond to that if you would.
The League of Women Voters is nonpartisan, so we will not comment on a connection of a political party to this effort. But we will comment on how, throughout our years of experience in monitoring drives to require photo ID, we do know it does dampen turnout, and we do know that in some cases, even our U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in different areas of the country that the effect was that the purpose was clear, that it the purpose was to dampen turnout from disadvantaged groups, and we know that the economically deprived are disadvantaged by this, in spite of the fact that the state does provide for paying for certain documents.
Okay.
To get it.
More questions from our listeners here. Anne from Midtown. Anne, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about Missouri's new photo ID law. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Anne.
Good to hear you. I'd like to know if my expired driver's license, expired in 16 last year, it's photographic, and may I use it?
An expired driver's license, Mr. Secretary, is that eligible for, make her eligible to vote next week?
Well, she's eligible to vote because she's registered. Thank you for calling in, Ann. And she can use that expired driver's license. Now, depending on when it expired, she may have to sign the statement, but she will be able to vote. She will vote a normal ballot, and I hope she does get out, and I hope that she makes sure her voice is heard and she participates.
Does that help, Ann?
It helps. Where can I be photographed for nothing? Are they going to photograph us at the polling place, which would be a good place?
Mr. Secretary?
I'm sorry, ma'am. I didn't quite hear what your question was.
She wants to know where she can have her picture taken to get her free ID to vote in the future, I think.
Yes.
What I would ask her to do is we'll need to get some information from her to help her with that. She can either go to our showitthenumber2vote.com website, or she can call us toll-free at 866-868-3245 and obviously want to help Ann, but that number and that website is for anyone that wants our help. We'll get some information and we'll start running down any underlying documents and get you the necessary IDs.
And Ann, we're going to put that phone number up on our website after the show today so you can go find it. Evelyn?
And Steve, we want you to know that we are not part of the fear-mongering mass that the Secretary has referred to. Our League of Women Voters are working very hard to prepare voters to be there at the be able to vote when they go to the polls. We have a phone number if any individual or any group would like to have meet with us, either for a group presentation or one-on-one, please call our number, which is 816-464-1800, and we will return calls to 816-464-1800.
Okay, let's go to Rich from Warrensburg. Rich, you're on up today. Good morning to you.
Good morning. My question is, if you sign up to get the state ID and that list is generated, does it remain confidential? The reason I ask is because I've been talking to people here in Warrensburg, and the word is that list is going to be immediately turned over to a county sheriff to check for wants and warrants.
Okay. Mr. Secretary, if you could keep your answer brief, I'd appreciate it.
That list is not going to be turned over for any sort of purpose like that, no.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank our good guests here for some information about the new voter photo voter ID in Missouri. Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft. Mr. Secretary, thank you for taking some time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Evelyn Maddox is co-president of the League of Women Voters for the Kansas City area and Jackson, Clay, and Platte counties as well. Evelyn, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Now, two stories about Department of Corrections policies and facilities. In Kansas, union officials have raised concerns about staffing shortages at the El Dorado Correctional Facility, and now state lawmakers want an audit. But first, let's address issues on the Missouri side with KCUR health editor and reporter Dan Margulies. Dan, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Dan, you reported yesterday on a new development in a lawsuit that was filed against the Missouri Department of Corrections by three inmates. First of all, what's this lawsuit about?
Right. So this lawsuit was filed back in December on behalf of the three inmates by the ACLU of Missouri. And what the lawsuit alleged was that the corrections department and the health care provider it contracts with have systematically denied appropriate medical treatment to prisoners with hepatitis C. The suit says it violates the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment and also violates the Americans with Disabilities Act.
So what's the latest development in this lawsuit? Where are we going here?
So the latest development is a ruling by the judge in the case that it can proceed as a class action. And that's a very big deal because we're talking here about possibly 5,000 or more inmates who have been diagnosed with hepatitis C, Steve. So assuming the case
5,000, Dan.
More than 5,000, yes. Mm-hmm. We don't have exact estimates because they're not really doing routine testing. That's part of the lawsuit. So assuming the case overcomes the legal hurdles that it still confronts and proceeds to trial, Missouri potentially could be facing the prospect of providing treatment, very expensive treatment for that matter, to thousands of inmates.
What is hepatitis C and how is it spread?
Right. So hepatitis C or HCV is a contagious viral infection that attacks and inflames the liver. It can be acute or it can be chronic. And people with chronic HCV can develop scarring of the liver, which in extreme cases can lead to cirrhosis of the liver. And cirrhosis is irreversible and can cause death. And at least half the people who have chronic HCV develop cirrhosis of the liver, and between 70 and 90% will develop chronic liver disease.
You said that the judge has certified the lawsuit as a class action. That means what?
Yeah, so a class action allows multiple individuals to sue as a group rather than one plaintiff at a time. And in this case, the judge has said that the Department of Corrections that the suit against the Department of Corrections can proceed as a class against the department and its medical provider, a private contractor called Corizon. So whether the inmates will prevail, I should be clear on this, is another matter. Again, they're claiming that the state is constitutionally and statutorily obliged to provide these treatments, very effective treatments that are available for hepatitis C. And that's very much a legal question, the answer to which is not certain. I will say that similar lawsuits have been filed in at least seven other states across the country.
Okay. That's KCUR Health Editor Dan Margulies telling us about the situation on the Missouri side. Dan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Let's turn to Kansas now. And yesterday, State Senator Laura Kelly, a Democrat from Topeka, asked for an investigation into recent uprisings at the El Dorado Correctional Facility down near Wichita. We're joined now by Kansas News Service reporter Sia Yopes Jepson. Sia, thanks for taking some time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Celia, what is this proposed audit about that Senator Laura Kelly is asking for here?
Well, so basically she's worried that details about these recent disturbances at the El Dorado facility have been emerging in media reports, and she thinks that the Department of Corrections maybe needs to be a bit more transparent about what's going on, because there seems to be a gap between what's emerging through the media and information that has come directly from the department. So that's what she's asking. She's asking the auditors to look into these incidents, what exactly happened, how serious were they, you know, and how did the department report them?
This notion of a lack of transparency appears to be becoming a bigger issue. Again, as you point out, the media seems to have broken several stories now about uprisings at a couple of different Kansas prisons, the one in El Dorado, the one up north in Lansing, much closer to Kansas City. What can you tell us about that?
Well, so what we know right now are the Wichita Eagle, the Associated Press, and the Star have they've turned up at least evidence of at least four disturbances at the El Dorado facility in particular. The Eagle has used the word uprisings to describe them. And so we're talking about incidents where inmates, for example, refused to go back to their cells or even took over parts of the facility. The Star found some evidence that at least one prisoner had a weapon in one of the incidents. And they said that that seemed to go beyond, or it seemed like the department had kind of downplayed the incident in its description of what happened. I asked the Department of Corrections about these incidents yesterday, four of the incidents, and they gave me details on two of them. So I think that's where, you know, lawmakers are a little concerned that there's a gap in descriptions.
And I should point out, in fairness, that the Department of Corrections in Kansas insists that it's been very upfront with information about all this.
Absolutely.
That's what they've indicated, at least anyway, right, Celia?
Yes, that is the case. They, you know, the a spokesman for the department yesterday told me in no uncertain terms they do not have a transparency problem.
At the same time, the union is complaining about a staffing shortage at some of the prisons here. Is that situation improving at all?
So that's a main concern of the union, and they say that workers are being told to work 12-hour shifts, even 16-hour shifts,
yeah,
to deal with the situation. So they're worried that the conditions aren't safe. They did say yesterday that they are working on it. In part, they emptied one of the cell houses at the El Dorado prison by moving the inmates to other facilities around the state. So they say that frees up 14 guards at the El Dorado facility to shift around. And also they're training new staff. So as of the start of July, they had 87 vacancies of their uniformed staff. So that includes like the guards, and that now they're down to about 73 vacancies. That's still, you know, a significant number of vacancies.
I'm really struck by the fact that the head of the state workers union in Topeka is saying that this entire situation with the prison system writ large here is like a powder keg ready to explode. That's kind of a foreboding kind of talk here.
It is. And actually, if I remember correctly, I think we first started hearing about the vacancy issues not long, I mean, just shortly before the news of the disturbances started coming out. So, you know, maybe that speaks to whether, you know, whether there is the type of direct link that the union is claiming.
This investigation that State Senator Laura Kelly is calling for, when is that going to take place?
So right now it's still a proposed legislative audit. That these things take a while because the committee that decides this doesn't meet that often. So they'll vote on it in October, and then the legislative auditors would probably start next year. So we wouldn't learn more through this process until next year.
If I understand correctly, there's a separate committee headed by Senator McGinn that's looking at taking a look at the prisons, even at a meeting as early as Thursday. Do you know much about that?
Well, I think that what they'll be talking about in part is potential raises. I would have to double check that. But that has been an issue, and there's been at least one Salina lawmaker that has talked about raises for the corrections employee, because we've known for a while that there is a high turnover rate. And now, as we know, vacancy issues as well.
That's J.R. Clays from Salina. I think the lawmaker is you're talking about. He's talking about a bill that would raise salaries by 20%. The hourly rate by 20% across the board.
Right. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Well, interesting times for the state correction system in Kansas. I want to thank the Kansas News Service reporter, Celia Yopes Jepson, for her time. Thanks so much for taking it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. You can download our podcast and listen to previous programs at kcur.org/uptodate. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, how returning service members are adjusting to civilian life through entrepreneurship. Also, we discuss what's delaying bike lanes in Kansas City. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell produce our show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.